You're listening to Self-Propelled, a podcast that explores the process of turning ideas into reality and the secrets behind keeping up momentum once you've started. I'm Dave Cornthwaite, and for 15 years I've experimented my way through a series of personal and social adventures, including Expedition 1000, a self-set mission to complete 25 different non-motorized journeys, each over 1,000 miles. I also founded the Yes Tribe, an optimistic community bonded by the idea of making the most of their time and potential, often by saying yes more. Join me for stories and conversations with self-starters, athletes, and entrepreneurs who need nothing more than a good idea to add a little fuel to that pilot light burning deep within us all. Welcome back to the Self-Propelled Podcast. My next guest is not only a good friend, but he is probably the most extreme adventurer we'll have on the show for quite some time. Sean Conway is an endurance athlete and adventurer, the first and only man in history to cycle, swim and run the length of Britain. He's also cycled around the world, crossed Europe on a bike faster than any other human. And this is probably my favourite adventure of his. He once climbed Kilimanjaro dressed as a penguin. The sheer scale and number of Sean's adventures are laid out in full on his website, seanconway.com. Sean, thanks for joining me, mate.
Hello, Dave. How's it going, man?
It's good.
You forgot about the Ginger Olympics we did.
Oh, I've got a little section put away for our silly little videos later. Sean, where are you right now? Describe your setting.
I am currently in North Wales, where I now live, looking out at a lovely blossoming tree that I don't know the name of, which I should know. It's in my garden. North Wales. It's sunny, which is pretty rare. So, yeah, enjoying that. I'm going to do some gardening later because, as the rest of the world, we're on lockdown central.
We'll come to what coronavirus has done to your livelihood soon, but I'd love to kind of start at the beginning. How long have you been in inverted commas an adventurer, and how did that kick off
in Adventureland? I can almost remember the month. It was May or June 2011. So basically, I turned 30 in April 2011, and I was just miserable, man. I had this dream as a kid. Like, I remember as a teenager going, man, I'm just going to be the world's best National Geographic photographer. And I, like, my neighbor gave me loads of old National Geographics, you know, and I'd sculpt the good pictures and laminate them and stick them around my bedroom. And, you know, I just lived and breathed photography. And I just thought, man, the camera is going to be my passport to traveling the world. You know, I think, you know, travel is super important anyway, but just for me, I wanted it to be my livelihood, you know, just discovering different ways of thinking, different peoples, different ideas. You know, I just loved all that, just discovering how other people lived their lives. And the camera was in my mind when I was 14, when I sort of picked up a camera, that was going to be my passport, you know, this to traveling the world. And then my 20s happened, and I just kind of lost my way. And I think a lot of people might relate to this. I didn't really have, I think I had the dream, but I didn't really apply it. Like, I was just kind of living in la-la land, you know? And instead of then going off and trying to get all these magazine gigs and creative jobs, because, you know, photography is a creative industry. However, it's one of the art forms where you can really be super uncreative and still do it. Mm. You know, you can, like what I did, I landed up being a school portrait photographer. And, you know, we all remember school photo day. It's basically, you know, passport pictures in front of a mottled background. Although that, when we did it, white backgrounds became the norm. So it was even more like a passport picture, pretty much. And that's what I did, man, like for 10 years, pretty much. So from when I was 20 all the way through to I was 30. And, you know, once you photograph your 10,000th, you know, kid for the year, you know, it just got dull. Like, it was just pack shot stuff. Like, I knew the formula. you know, these poses sold well. If I photographed X amount of children, I would turn over this amount of money. Like, it was just maths and money. There was no sort of creativity and that sort of thing. And yeah, so it was just after my 30th birthday when I sort of realized, why am I not traveling the world? You know, like, what happened? And then, you know, what's interesting, actually, a friend of mine was like, you know, I regaled this story a few years after. My friend was like, oh, wow, man, that must have been really tough for you, you know, trying to get all these magazine gigs and work for National Geographic and not getting them, so having to settle for the nurseries. And I suddenly, and I was like, you know what? And then he asked, so how many, like, you know, how many National Geographic jobs did you go for? And the answer was zero.
Yeah.
Not one. So I don't know what I was, like, I don't know what was going through my head. Like, so I was just had this, like this dream. But I guess it was a confidence thing. I think I had the dream, and for a while I was just living, you know, when you're in your 20s, it can still be a dream for a while because you're quite young and you feel maybe you don't have to, if you don't achieve it now, then, you know, you still got the rest of your life to achieve it. But then, like, time goes by quickly, you know, time goes, and then all of a sudden you're 30, and then when you turn 30, you think you're really old. I mean, it was kind of a nice kick up the ass, to be honest. But, you know, and so I was living in this, yeah, La La Land, where I guess I just, like, I almost preferred having the dream and playing out the dream in my mind than the reality of fighting for it and potentially not making it, because then I knew the dream would be over. I think that was, it was probably a little bit of that in the situation. And yeah, I mean, it just came down to confidence and belief and that sort of thing in your ability and just going for it, right? You know, and then, so anyway, so when I turned 30, I sort of scrapped it all and sold my business for £1 to my business partner and walked away, and then was thinking, well, I still want to go traveling, but I kind of had no money, you know, because the more money you earn, especially when you live in London, you know what it's like, the more money you spend. And all you land up doing is you just buy more expensive versions of the things you already have. You know, like, you still go out to a restaurant, but you'll go and spend 50 quid instead of 30 quid, you know. You'll still drive a car, but you'll just drive one that's maybe a little bit more expensive. And you'll just buy a bigger TV, you know. So, like, it kind of didn't, it doesn't really change your, if you're not clever, of course, you know, money has, you know, can allow you to travel and you can buy a bicycle, which will change your life. You don't need as much as you think, you know. And I think, so yeah, at 30, I was like, right, I need to go traveling. But I had no money. So I thought, right, what if I try and break some sort of record in the world of travel? I was thinking outside the box, you know. And, you know, it was, I'd seen people like you and Al Humphreys and Mark Beaumont, you know, all the sort of, in our generation, the guys who started early on and had been doing it for ages. And I was super inspired by you guys. And I was like, man, I just, if they can do it, blimmin' hell, like, it must be a thing. Like, people must choose silly, stupid things. Look at this Dave Cornthwaite guy skateboarding across Australia. Well, look, I mean, he must have got sponsors and, you know, he must have got people to sort of get behind the idea, whether it's just support or, you know, paying for your flights and things like that. So yeah, that's kind of, it's your fault, Dave, basically.
Why is it that I've seen your photography and you're a great photographer.
I photographed your cover of Date.
Anyone you did. Yeah, there's a little tidbit for everybody. My second book, Date, was all about dating, not adventure, although it was a dating adventure, and Sean snapped the cover shot for that. That was a fun day.
Oh, it's a very good book, actually. Genuinely, I loved it. Yeah, it's great for reading on the toilet.
You might need to use it for the toilet soon. Well,
it's probably cheaper to use your book to, instead of toilet paper nowadays.
As soon as people run out, just drop me a line and I'll send you a copy. There's plenty left. So you have this talent for photography, but editing photos as well. And I know that it's not easy to make a living from photography or adventure. You know, it takes a lot of discipline, a huge amount of application and determination. What was it about the world of adventure that gave you more drive than the photography?
I think, well, so the first thing I did, so after when I decided, right, I want to go traveling, let's try and break a record, which will potentially help, you know, get the thing off the ground financially, because I had no money, you know, because my parents don't have money. I couldn't go to them. I have no A-levels. I didn't go to university. So I was kind of in this, and I was 30 years old. So I was in this weird space where I was kind of, I mean, dare I say it, unemployable, but like a 30-year-old with no CV, no A-levels and no university anything. It's quite a tough place to be, you know? So I thought, right, let me go traveling. But the first thing I thought was the cycle around the world race, which happened in 2012. So I entered that and trained hard and got some sponsors to, you know, buy me a bicycle and pay for my flights and that sort of thing. The intention was to use it as a gap year, which I didn't have after school, to then fall back in love with photography. Like, that was the genuine intention. So I thought, right, spend a year, train hard, go for this round the world race. I wanted to win it. I wanted to break the world record. And then I'll get back to London and I'll hopefully have found this drive and passion for travel photography, you know, that I didn't have, at the time, you know, cause I was just sick of it. So I went off and did that round the world ride. I got run over in America, and that's a whole different story. But basically, I didn't break the record. Well, couldn't break the record after the accident. So I carried on slowly for charity anyway. When I got back, I tried to get back into photography. You know, I was sort of looking at jobs within, you know, photo labs again, which I worked at for many years while I was building up the photography and finding studios, maybe. I mean, I wasn't that excited about sort of getting into a studio-based environment because I wanted to, that's what I left. I needed to make some money, you know. I was so skint, you know. I was living with mum at the age of 31 in a one-bedroom flat in Cheltenham on the sofa, you know. It was freaking fine. But in the meantime, I thought, well, let me try and get some cycling jobs as well. So I was emailing Sustrans to try and see if they had a bike it campaign back then, where you sort of got given an area, and you know you were meant to sort of look after yourself and go into schools and try and convince kids to cycle or walk to school rather than getting a lift with mum and dad, trying to get people to cycle or walk into work instead of driving, you know. And it was great. So I tried loads of those jobs. I tried to get other jobs in bike shops because I, you know, I'd just done this big epic cycle around the world, you know. But I was just getting nothing, man. I was just literally getting nothing. And then it was actually, I remember speaking to you about it. I was umming and ahhing about writing the book, but then I was like, so many people have done around the world cycle books, you know, why is mine going to be any different? I remember you said something to me, Dave, and it's stuck with me ever since. And I tell other people this as well, that don't write it for other people, sort of write it for your future grandkids, you know, or, you know, write it for yourself. And then the sales are just a happy bonus. But if you write this thing, you know, and you do it for yourself, it becomes this hobby, like writing becomes this pleasurable experience, you know, like I'm into knife making and woodwork and, you know, I don't make a knife to try and sell it. I make it because I enjoy it. And if you have the same philosophy about writing a book, you actually then enjoy the process. And if you sell it, that's great. If you don't, you've got this legacy for your future grandkids. And my son hopefully will be super proud of me when he reads about that time I had to use the skeleton bone of a dead dog as toilet paper in the middle of the Atacama Desert. You know, that's the thing, you know, like, And yeah, so I thought, well, I'll write the book. And then, you know, a year went by and I was really skint, man. Like I went on the dole after my round the world cycle because I was living with mum, just trying to get work, but, you know, get back into the system, as it were, of employment. Because, you know, living in a one bedroom flat with your mother at 31 isn't the best for your mental state, you know. And then all of a sudden, you know, people started, you know, I wrote bits of the book and people were enjoying them. They are sending them to family. And, you know, a few people got me in for talks, which was kind of, I got a buzz out of it and it was quite exciting. But anyway, after a year, I was like, well, I'm just not getting any work. Like, just no one wants to employ me for whatever reason. maybe I should go off and just do another challenge. You know, like if I did another, if I do another big epic, firstly, you know, I'm away for 6 months. So that means I'm not in my mother's hair, you know, because she was getting sort of annoyed with having a 31-year-old on her sofa, as you can imagine. So that's when I thought, well, let me just think of something else. And, you know, if I'm lucky, I'll get enough money to pay for food, basically, for me to be away. And then that's when I sort of came up with the idea to swim the length of Britain. Again, you were very much involved in that decision making because you were swimming down the Missouri at the time. And I thought, well, swimming looks fun. selective Facebook sharing, I think, David.
I was honest with you before you made your final call.
We're very honest with me. But I was like, oh, well, you know, look, he's camping on the side of the river. He's got fires. This looks awesome. He's got, you know, he's got his posse with him. This looks really fun. Yeah, little did I know it's not fun at all, as you know. Yeah, so that's when I thought of swimming the length of Britain back then. And then, you know, fast forward to completing that. You know, that was then all of a sudden the sort of moment when I finished, where I just thought, wow, like I'd never really achieved anything big that I'd really put my mind to in life. Like I'd, you know, I'd won a few photography awards, but you know, like you just kind of get given awards in photography. You don't kind of fight for them, you know, you don't go out and purposefully go for them, you know, and whereas this was the first thing I'd just really gone, you know what, I'm going to freaking put everything into this. I'm going to put my entire life, soul, everything into trying to make this big project happen. And then when it happened, I just, this overwhelming feeling of sort of like what I could achieve, like this confidence came over me. And I think that's the reason I then, from then on, kind of carried on pursuing the same buzz, you know, the same buzz of winning or achieving a big goal. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, it's not about the destination, it's all about the journey. I'm like, sod that, man, freaking I want to win. Like, you know, it's no, I want to do what I do, and I want to sort of kind of like break records and stuff, because I don't know, that's kind of my, that gets me out of bed every day. I'm not a very good traveler, I think. I need the big scary stuff, you know.
I think that's what sets you apart in this world where so many people are out there doing all of these journeys. And for me, I'm a slow traveler. I like chatting to people, and I've never been after the finish line, the record, the race. But you were talking about your round the world cycle ride and rode straight over this, excuse the pun, but you were hit by a car. Was it in Tennessee, Arkansas?
In Arkansas.
So before that, you were gunning for this record. You were fairly on pace. And then afterwards, could you tell us a little bit what happened, you know, in that moment, and then how your motivation had to change for the rest of that ride as you didn't have a record to chase anymore?
Yeah, I mean, that was tough. I mean, firstly, I don't remember anything from the accident. I went to bed the night before in a motel, and then I woke up briefly. I kind of remember being on the side of the road with, I could see red and blue lights. And I remember someone saying, oh, you've been in an accident. And I also did the classic. I said, how's my bike? And I remember saying, oh, it's pretty totaled, man. And I remember at the time going, what? Just lie to me now. Like, I'm dying on the side of the road. Just tell me my bike's okay, you know, while I'm dying. You know, and I just remember being quite annoyed that they didn't lie to me. And then I kind of don't remember anything. And then I was, like, in the hospital, and I kind of remember something, but not really. Yeah, so I don't have the traumatic experience of being run over, but basically what happened is I was cycling down the road, and to be honest, it was a road, if you knew the area, you would never in a million years cycle down it. You know, it was one of these sort of real busy roads with no hard shoulder, Real bad tarmac as well, so you're kind of slowing and swerving around potholes and things. But you know what it's like. You know, you're just following a line on a map. You don't know any different. And this gentleman speeding, late for work, early in the morning. It was 6 a.m. To break the round the world record back then, I was sort of getting up at about 4 or 5 a.m. cycling through till about 10 or 11. But actually, that the night before, I'd had a really good sleep because there was this tornado. So I'd actually had my first like 9 hour sleep before that. So I presume I was feeling quite fresh. He was on his phone, and you know, there was a red traffic light ahead, and it was raining. So I think the red light of the traffic light reflecting off the red in the road from the lights with my red light. I can, you know, and also you just never expect to see a cyclist at 5 a.m. on a, you know, one busy sort of roads. And he just hit me from behind doing 50 miles an hour, and I went up onto the windscreen and whatever. But anyway, I genuinely, in my naivety, thought I could still carry on and break the record. You know, Guinness have this 2-week rule, so you're allowed to not make progress for 2 weeks and still carry on. So I thought, you know, I remember apparently I was telling the doctors, like, I'll be fine, you know, 2 weeks, I'll be back on and I'll be going. And they're like, man, you've got a compression fracture in your spine. You've got chipped teeth, whiplash, concussion, torn ligaments in your knee, your ankle. but visually I looked fine. I had a couple of chipped teeth, but I didn't have any like blood on my head or like on my face. So like weird, like when I looked in the mirror, I was like, well, I'm fine. I've just got a sore back and knees and ankles and that. But yeah, weirdly, because basically I must have swerved at the last minute, like instinctively, because he hit me from the right. So I must have tried to swerve off the road. And then when he hit me, he must have swerved as well. And it sort of bounced me onto some grass. So actually, I had a kind of a soft landing, really. So the impact was the bonnet on my spine. But yeah, sort of. So in my head, I was going to carry on for the record. That kind of soon, after a couple of weeks, I realized, well, the record's completely out of shot, not only because of my physical ability, but the, you know, the legend that is Mike Hall, who sadly we lost a few years ago when he got run over in Australia. He was in the race as well, and he was absolutely blasting it, man. He was just beautiful to watch, you know, when he was just like going up a hill. It was just nice, steady cadence. You know, he wasn't rocking side to side. His technique was amazing. He just had this, like, he's from Yorkshire, and he just had this dry, sort of unassuming bit of, you know, aura about him. And he's just, what a machine, man. So anyway, his stats, and he was smoking it, man. At that time, I was in America. I think he had just got to the edge of Europe, and I think he was blasting across India or something. Man, he was flying. I couldn't break the record, so of course I was going to come home. I was like, well, there's no point carrying on, I'm just going to come home. And then I suddenly kind of, I was packing up my bags, and I saw this little Olympic torch that some kids gave me. So it was 2012, some kids in Greenwich made me a little Olympic torch, and they said, oh, Sean, can you take this around the world for us and bring it back to London in time for the Olympics? And at the time I thought, oh, that's kind of cute, yeah, why not. And I remember I was packing my bags, and I saw this torch, and I was just like, oh man, they're going to be gutted. You know, these kids are just going to be so disappointed. Like, they had a whole project. They used like a 3D printer. It had a little battery in it with a switch, so it had like a flickering bulb in the top. Oh man, it was so well done. And like, they put so much effort into it. I thought, man, I got to carry on for these. I got to take this torch around the world, you know? And that kind of became this kind of new focus and new energy. And you know, there's loads of famous sayings on the internet, but the sort of the one that I guess gets thrown around is, this you know, there's more than one way you can climb up a mountain, you know. And you know, I possibly couldn't now do the famous fast route, but it doesn't mean I still couldn't get to the top of the mountain another way, you know. And I think that was in my head, that's the reason I sort of, that gave me the energy to carry on. And also, I was sort of trying to work out the statistics and of getting run over twice in life. I figured that's pretty low. Like, I figured it's pretty low. Like, no one gets, like, a serious, like, accident twice, right? Like, if you've had one, the chance of having a second one surely must be pretty low. So that was also my reasoning behind carrying on, you know?
Is that what you told your mum?
That's what I told my parents, yeah. Mum and dad, by the way, no one gets run over twice in life. I've had my turn. I'm carrying on.
How did you play each day after that accident? Obviously the record was gone, but you have a great deal of internal motivation. So were you still aiming for a certain mileage? If you had to travel slower, then did you find that you enjoyed it more, or you were just frustrated?
I was very frustrated. I also still didn't want to just go on a jolly. I also only had enough money to be out on the road for like 3 months, 4 months maybe with flights, because, you know, you plan a daily budget to be out on the road. And, you know, the record I was at the time was sort of 120 days. So, you know, I was seeing if I could do sub 100 days back then. So, you know, 3.5 months really. I didn't have any more money to stay out much longer than that, anyway, other than really reducing my costs, which on hindsight, I totally could have. Of course I could have. I could have really just become an Al Humphreys, you know, living on bread and ketchup. but in my head, I just didn't want to do that. You know, I still wanted to push myself physically. And I still kind of had a goal, because I needed to get back to London in time for the Olympics. So actually, when I was sort of doing the maths with a slightly shorter route, so I then didn't do the whole north bit of Australia. I only did Sydney to Darwin when I was planning to do Sydney to Perth along the top, so the long way around. So I cut a few legs short because I was super delayed on my flights as well, and I couldn't afford to keep changing all my flights. So that was the main one I sort of cut distance-wise. So I cut a bit of mileage, worked out that actually to get back to London in time for the Olympics, I needed to do 130 miles a day or 120. It was pretty easy, like, after then. You know, because bear in mind, before that, in America especially, I was doing 200 miles a day. And the difference between 200 miles a day and 130 is phenomenal. You know, you can have sit-down meals, for example, and you can chat to people, and you don't have to do that real sketchy graveyard shift either at night or in the morning. So you could kind of almost stick, not quite to daylight hours, but you could sort of, I was still getting up at about 5 a.m., but then probably finishing at around 7 or 8 rather than 10 at night, you know. But then again, I was getting frustrated because, you know, I was just that feeling you get when your bike hits 200 miles and you've done that 3 days in a row, man. Oh, I don't know. I just got a real, that made me excited. And just being an average cyclist, really, I really struggled with that, to be honest. for the rest of the ride, to be honest, like all the way. And the only thing that kept me going was this little Olympic torch, I guess, that I was using to get back to London in time for the Olympics, you know?
Yeah. I don't think I did justice to you maybe 10 minutes ago when I said that what sets you apart is your goals within your adventures. The fact that you just go flat out hard and fast. I'd like to add a little bit more to that, which I think for me shapes how you're defined in adventure land or adventure world. Not only have you broken so many records, you've done things faster than other people, gone further, but at the same time, on the homepage of your website, there are three different main links: successes, dreams, and then hiccups. So while you take these things incredibly seriously when you're in the middle of them, you also manage to remain humble alongside. I've never had a sense of ego from you. Why is it important to you to be able to so easily highlight your failures and laugh at these things too?
You probably get it as well. Like, you meet some people who, you know, they just think you're one of those outliers. So basically, you know, there's some people who they'll watch and they'll feel a kind of inspired by you, but they'll also consider you an outlier. And if you're an outlier, you almost then become less inspiring because they just think you're a freak of nature, right? You know, Usain Bolt is one of those people. Like, of course, I'm super inspired by what Usain Bolt's done. If anyone has not watched his documentary, I really urge you to watch it. It's amazing just to see what he gets up to and stuff. But a part of me goes, well, he's just an outlier. He's just a freak of nature. You know, he's got this, he's biologically different. So although I'm kind of inspired by his work ethic and things like that, there's no way I could sort of be like him because he's just a freak of nature, right? And I found there was some people, you know, because I always thought people kind of presumed I was just this normal kid. You know, I don't come from a military background. I wasn't, you know, I didn't go to posh school in England. I wasn't ex-army. I wasn't an ex-Olympian, you know. I wasn't famously from a historic corner of society that mainly did exploration over the last couple of hundred years. You know, I didn't fall in line with any of those things. So I kind of presume people knew I was just like average guy. Because I've been tested. I've been tested in the same labs as the Brownlee brothers, Chris Froome, Jensen Button. Like, they all get tested in this lab in London. And they invited me in. And it's quite funny. I don't know if you've been for these tests where they do it like salt loss, power, VO2 max, sweat rate, you know, all these cognitive things. You know, when you go in, you're like, special, man. Like, come on. Like, there's something in me that scientists are going to discover and I'm going to be written about for 100 years, you know. There must be something special about me. I want to be different. Anyway, so I went for these tests, and like a few weeks later, I went back in for the results, and I remember the guy sitting, and he hadn't seen the results. He sort of just gets passed them by the guys in the lab, and he's sitting there at the table with me, and he's looking through. He starts on page one. He's like, "Hey, Sean, wow, you've done some cool stuff." He doesn't really know who I am, but he's just looking at the figures. And he's like, you can see in his eyes, like, man, we're going to find some cool stuff about you here, man. He's going through page one and he's like, his face drops a little bit. It's page two, face drop. Anyway, by the end, he's just like, mate, literally, you are like Joe average. He said, if anything, you have a disadvantage because I lose nearly 3 times as much salt in my sweat as most people. So most people lose a gram and a half. I lose 3.4 grams of salt per liter of sweat. So I just have this deficiency where I just need to have tons and tons of salt the whole time. But yeah, I was noticing. So anyway, I am Joe Bloggs, but I kind of thought people knew that. But I was going to talks at schools and working with the scouts and even going and doing my sort of public speaking at big offices like, you know, Google and things like that. And you've done the same. And every now and then I have these people who just presume you're an outlier. You know, they're just like, oh, yeah, but you can do this because you're a freak of nature. And it's kind of got annoyed by it because I was trying to like tell people like, I'm not, like, genuinely, I'm not, like, I've been tested. But they just kind of weren't, they just kind of didn't believe me. They're like, nah, come on, man. Like, come on. You must be just one of these freaks. So then I was like, you know what? I just need to show people all the stuff I've really messed up, you know, the stuff I've not won at, the stuff I've failed at and things like that. And if I just like, and just, it's just factual. There's no emotion in it. It's like, I tried to do this and it didn't happen because I got injured or I didn't try hard enough or I lost motivation or, you know, there's loads of reasons I've not, you know, completed a goal or a challenge. So I started putting them on my website, and it's weirdly it's my most visited link on my website, I think, is the hiccup page.
I mean, there's a lot on there.
There's a lot of hiccups. There's a lot of hiccups, man. And I purposely wanted to call them hiccups because I think also, you know, you can you can really concentrate on the stuff that goes wrong. So much so that it affects the ability for you to make something go right in the future. If you don't treat a failure with its correct sort of respect and what it did, what all a failure is, you know, you should respect failure because it's an opportunity to learn. But also you shouldn't put it on a pedestal. You know, you shouldn't, you know, your today's failure, if anything, has more positive reason to succeed tomorrow than ever, you know. So I've always said that. So yeah, again, that's why I wanted to call it hiccups rather than failures, you know. It's because in my head it's like, oh well, you know what, it didn't work out this time, I'm gonna have another crack at it.
Yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no big deal. How about the inner workings? I saw you shared one of Al Humphrey's, as usual, excellent posts and shares about, you know, the average inner workings of an adventurer's day-to-day life. How do you go about this? You know, I think a lot of people kind of assume that this is all sponsorship driven, that you got lucky at some point, but the reality is probably a lot more banal. How do you organize day-to-day? Do you have a to-do list? Do you have an agent? Where do sponsorships and talks and things like that come from for you?
Yeah, so you know what? When I finish the swim, and I have to give him a shout out, Ben Fogle really, really was amazing. He really helped me out. Like, literally the day I finished the swim, he invited me to London to meet his wife, and there was this event that he wanted me to go at. And, you know, at the end of that, and I remember sitting down, and he was like, oh man, you know, you really need to write a book about the swim. I'll put you in touch with an agency who will have a look at it, and then hopefully they can get a publisher for you, and you know, maybe you can get someone who can just put you out into the connections. And you know, because in the world of adventure, you know, I'm on the sports side, so you know, all sport is really only a kind of achievable through sponsorship, really. All sport in the world pretty much relies almost entirely on sponsorship, for the most part. Of course, you know, the big sports will get UK sport grants and funding and that sort of thing, but for the most part people have to go out and get sponsorship. And Ben was amazing. I remember sitting at this thing, you know, I'd never met Ben before, and he's this big celebrity TV guy who's like hangs out with royalty and stuff, you know? And that night, hilariously, after this big fancy dinner in Mayfair, he's like, oh, do you want a taxi to your hotel? And I didn't have the balls to tell him that actually I was sleeping in the back of my car. So I was just like, hey, yeah, my car's up in North London. Not my car. I was like, ah, oh, I lied. I said, oh, I've got a hotel in North London. Just send me to Muswell Hill, which is where I used to live in London back in the day, which is where my car was parked, outside my old apartment. It was hilarious. And I literally, it was a little hatchback, so I had to put the back seat down and sleep like with my legs in the boot, after this like dinner in Mayfair. But I remember thinking, ah, you know, is he gonna follow through? Like, is he just saying all this stuff just to, you know, to be a nice guy? But literally, like, before I woke up the next day, I had emails from him and his wife Marina. She was just like, ah, got this great, you know, agent who's going to hopefully look, you know, will want to look at your book and blah, blah, blah. And he just was super helpful. And he kind of made me realize that actually, you know, you can kind of make a livelihood out of this. I mean, I'd seen you and Al and Mark Beaumont. I guess the three of you were the people I'd kind of in my circle before that. Well, when I say my circle, the people I sort of could relate to, because you know, you weren't an Everest person or a polar person, which I didn't relate to at the time. You know, you guys were sort of doing something I thought, wow, that's kind of cool. But then to actually get Ben to sort of give me these contacts and actually tell me, like, listen, like, if you write a book about this, like, people will read it. I hadn't really thought of that properly before, you know. So Ben sort of helped me out and then put me into that sort of the world of adventure. But I'm still very much like I'm just so unbusiness. I'm terrible, man. Like my email, let me have a look here. 75 flagged emails and The last flagged one goes back to July last. I really need to reply to that one. July last year. Oh, crap.
Oh, mate, this drives me crazy. Even imagining what your inbox looks like.
Like, I'm just terrible at the business of adventure because it's, for me, it's super important. Like, yes, I need to pay the bills. I've got a son. I need to think about nursery fees and blimmin' nappies, man. Holy moly. Like, I think the average is like 3,000 nappies in year one. And I was like, nah, but blimmin' hell. He's a wild one in that department. Of course I need to think of my family and that sort of thing. So I don't really have a sort of like actual daily like program. Like, I don't think of it like properly. What I do is I work on projects. So, for example, I've not actually done anything, can you believe it, for 2 years now. So and that project took me 2 years to do. So my Across Europe self-supported world record attempt, I did in 2018. I finished in May 2018. I started thinking about that at the end of 2016. I was planning to do it in 2017, which I tried, and that was a hiccup on my website. Pulled out that one, retrained, went back in 2018. So actually, since end of 2016 till now, I've actually only done 25 days of a big challenge. You know, of course, I've done little things here and there with my family and just for my mindset. But, you know, I've not done anything, you know, for a couple of years now, because at the moment, I wanted to get married. I wanted to have a son, which I did, or a child. It happened to be a son. I was secretly hoping for a girl because my wife's Welsh. So I thought it'd be cool if we had Indiana as a first name, Jones, because my wife's Welsh, Conway, Indiana Jones Conway. It'd be brilliant. Anyway, that didn't happen. So we got our son called Monty Montgomery. And, you know, I wanted to sort of, you know, spend a bit of time, you know, with my family and that sort of thing. So that's been the last few years. But let's say, back to your question, so what does a day-to-day look like? If I'm writing, which I'm always writing, to be honest, I will do a few hours in the morning, probably three maximum. After 3 hours, I find the quality goes down. So I do 3 hours of writing in the morning. I'll then probably go for a run. At the moment, I'm really getting into running a little bit more now. It's been cycling really for the last three or four years, but I'm actually quite enjoying just getting out on the trails, and it's just sort of hassle free and you don't have to worry about traffic and that sort of thing. And then come home, and, you know, do a few emails, but probably as you've just seen, I'm pretty terrible at that. If I'm doing a talk, I'll sort of, you know, plan the talk, and a bit like you, you know, do quite a lot of talks because I get a real buzz out of it. You know, that moment I walk on stage is kind of the same as on the start line for something big, you know, just that nervous excitement type thing. And I actually wore a heart rate monitor once for a talk, and my heart rate was pretty low. It was a little bit above normal backstage. And then as soon as someone went on stage to announce me, oh man, it went up to like 150 or 160, and it stayed there until I walked on stage. And then once I delivered the first few lines, to set the tone for the talk, you know, and depending on the audience, you know, you change that beginning bit. It then went back down to kind of normal again for the rest of the talk. Yeah, it was super interesting, just this like big spike in the beginning, and it's kind of the same buzz you get when you're on the start line of something big, you know, you just get that whoa, and then once you're into it a little bit. Planning talks and writing books and things like that, and then I just love my hobbies, you know. So for my sort of my mental health, it's super important for me to make or fix things, you know. So I like brewing ale, and I like making. I'm into knife making, so that's haven't got a forge yet. It's going to be my next thing, but so at the moment I'm just buying the sheet steel, cutting it out into a shape, and then you know, getting it sharp and then getting some nice wood to make a handle and that sort of thing. So I'm really into that and fixing old cars. I like my old classic cars. So I was doing up an old Ford Mustang up until, well, I've just sold it actually, because I had fun with it and I'm going to try a different project now. Might get an old Land Rover. So yeah, so I spend some time doing my hobbies and that sort of thing. And then just family time, you know, it's just been great. You know, working from home, you know, you've got to, you know, one of the reasons I've chosen to sort of be self-employed, be an author, is I get to be at home with my family. And it'd be stupid for you to not make the most of that. You know, like I'm very much, I'm not in the, right, 9 o'clock, I get changed into a suit and go into my office in the back room of the house and work until 5 o'clock. Like, I might as well just go and, you know, work in an office then, in my head. So, you know, I'm very flexible. If I'm not in the mood to write, I'll write anyway, because I think it's important to keep that habit. But I'll be flexible, you know. Sometimes I'll write maybe in the evening, or I'll take my laptop and go and sit by the river if it's hot, or, you know, up a mountain and that sort of thing. So, yeah, you've got to take the advantage of working from home, you know, to make the most of it, you know.
Yeah, of course. I love hearing you talk about life as it is now. I remember the first time we met in person and everything about you. It might sound a little glib just saying, you know, it's amazing how much changes, how much we mature over the course of a decade. I mean, that's obvious. But when we met, it was in a square in London, I forget which one, and you were clean shaven. Andy Brown was doing a fundraiser ahead of his Atlantic rowing record. And I remember liking you immediately. But also, you know, you were full of the excitement of that first big adventure around the corner.
I wish I'd known that would never come back.
But so much has changed since then, Sean. You know, not only have you managed to grow some facial hair, and some quite considerable facial hair, it should be said, but you have a family now. You're settled down to a degree.
I've got a bungalow, mate.
That happened maybe 20 years too soon, didn't it?
Future-proofing my life, brother.
I have so many fond memories of our friendship, and some of them are really, really stupid. If as listeners, you want to dig in and find some of these, there are some lovely little moments on YouTube, which always make me smile when I come across them at some point. We did a cheeky little Vox Pop film called Big Swimmers. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that one.
This is worth going to just because it's pre-beard for Sean, and we were just playing around with each other's lack of motivation, perhaps in our mutual swims. We also did a little film in my parents' garden called Ginger Olympics.
That was amazing. I can hold my breath longer than Dave. That's all.
So funny.
It was a draw. We're meant to have round two of that.
We should definitely do that at some point. Sean, do you get bored? You know, you're project oriented. Obviously, as you said, you've in the last 4 years, you've spent less than 30 days in the midst of an adventure, which people would probably class as your career. And of course, all of the preparation, the talks that follow are almost not remembered. Isn't it amazing that the legacy of the stories generated by these adventures and these projects? Is that what keeps you going to fill each moment working towards something, whether it's a big adventure or, you know, your dreams of creating a forge at home one day?
Yeah, totally. And I as I said, like, for my mental well-being, I need to like make stuff or fix stuff. And yeah, you're right. I never get bored ever, because I've got so many things I want to do. at the moment, you know, we've just moved to North Wales and, you know, fixing up the house a little bit. So at the moment, I'm trying to put some posts in the garden. So that's keeping me busy in the evening. Whether it's writing my books, whereas it's the hobbies, you know, I've always got stuff I want to do. I'm terrible when I am bored. And I think, like, if I've got nothing to do, I'm like, my wife hates me. Like, she's just like, just go and do something. Just go into the garage. And I think she now gives me things to do, even though she doesn't need them. She's like, oh, I really love a shelf in the bathroom. So I'm like, on it. Honey, I'm going to build you the best shelf in the world. So that's like, okay, well, at least he's now busy and his headspace is good. And because, you know, the other thing is people find surprising is I'm not massively sport driven outside of doing a big challenge. And I wish I was, like, you know, especially you read these books, you know, like Dean Karnazes and Rich Roll and, you know, all these people who just go, man, if I don't go for a run in the morning, I just can't operate that day. And I'm like, I wish I had that. Like, I do. Like, I don't know why it is. I think it's because I'm saving it for when I need it. You know, I think what I don't want is to sort of fall out of love with doing it, because when I'm out doing these big sort of challenges, adventures, although I hate it and it's miserable, I get such a buzz out of the process, and I would hate to sort of overtrain and do too much. And I guess that in my head, but I kind of wish I had this like love for going out for a run every single day. Don't get me wrong, like I still go out 2 or 3 times a week, but you know, I certainly don't have that sort of every day I have to go and do something big, which is kind of a shame. I kind of wish I did have it, to be honest.
Well, I think this is a perfect place to start talking about what we're currently facing around the world, not just individually. It's mid-March as we talk, and we've managed to go 50 minutes without mentioning coronavirus. For the first time, so many people are realizing just what it's like to spend all day, every day at home. And that's a real struggle for most. I have a feeling it's not necessarily a struggle for you, but how has COVID-19 affected your life? How's it impacted on work?
So, yeah, a bit like, firstly, all the events I was meant to be involved in, whether it be public speaking or I was meant to go to the Berlin Travel Festival, for example, and be on stand with one of my sponsors, with Echo Shoes, who I've worked with developing a new trail shoe. You know, like we were gonna sort of launch this trail shoe at Berlin that I've helped develop with them for the last 18 months, and it's, you know, I'm super proud of it. You know, and it's like when you have a big organization like that, who go, you know, what do you think? What sort of lacing pattern should we go for? Man, they're asking me and I give them some advice and they actually go through with it. It's like, whoa, man, that's so cool. You know, they've got my little stamp on it, you know, whether, you know, it's just the lacing pattern, but I don't care, you know, and there's some colors involved and that sort of thing, you know. Yeah, so that got canceled. That was a real bummer because I was so looking forward to sort of launching this shoe. All my public speaking engagements have been cancelled at schools and corporates and that sort of thing, which is a real shame, you know, because I get such a buzz out of them as well. And my training, I've got a big challenge coming up later this year. I was meant to go to America for a big training block. That got cancelled. I then changed the location to Spain. That got cancelled. Of course, and so now I'm gonna have to train here in Wales on just day trips out, you know, which for me is I don't get the quality of training as I would if I went off and did a proper block of 2 weeks or 3 weeks, you know. So that's how it's really affected me, sort of from my day-to-day livelihood in the world of adventure is mainly my speaking and my training, that which I was meant to do away abroad. But the other thing that's actually a little bit, because at the beginning when this was sort of going out, I was sort of very selfish about it, if I'm honest. I was like, in my head, I was like, well, I'm young, I'm fit, you know, I'll be fine, you know. But then actually my wife sort of reminded me that, you know, we live in the same village as her parents. They're in the at-risk category, as is another one of our family members has diabetes. So they're at the at-risk category. So all of a sudden you start thinking, actually, if I went to town to buy some food and got it, I may not get it in the sense of feeling ill, but, you know, imagine I passed it on to my wife's parents, or you know, like, that's bad, you know. So actually at the moment, the quarantine, you know, we're sort of self-isolating to a degree. We're not panic buying, so we haven't bought loads of food, so we still need to go out and buy food. I still go out and do the shopping because I don't want to be part of that system where we're responsible for that, because I think, you know, I don't think that's particularly helpful for anyone. But yeah, we are now sort of thinking, well, should we go and see granny and granddad down the road? You know, I you know, we're sort of deciding probably we shouldn't really. So yeah, so that's it. So I bought a treadmill, you know, I bought a treadmill in my office, and that's me now. But actually, you know, I've lots to do at home, as I say, and, you know, you've just touched on it. I'm doing all my hobbies. I'm doing a bit of gardening, which is quite nice. I quite enjoy getting my hands dirty, making some things. My latest thing, actually, oh man, you'll probably appreciate it. I'm going to make the world's most epic outdoor shower. So I'm sort of run. Basically, the tap's at the wrong end of the garden. So I'm going to dig up a hole all the way up. So we live on the side of a hill, and we've got tiers in the garden, which is so impractical. Trying to mow them is impossible. But right at the top tier, you can overlook the top of the house. So I want to put this outdoor shower top tier. So I'm going to go and dig a hole in the grass, bury a hose pipe, and run it all the way up to top tier. And then I can just sort of plug it into the tap at the bottom of the garden, turn it off, and have this epic outdoor shower, man. Oh, it's going to be beautiful. Oh, so that stuff like that gets me super excited. I should be going for a run, but I'm going to make an outdoor.
Absolutely love it. I'm going to come and visit you in your new bungalow, only to use the shower.
I'm really like, I'm getting super involved. I'm like, well, what sort of wood should I use for the shower pillar? Because you've got to sink some wood in the ground that looks nice, right? I'm like, should I use some iroko or maybe some cedar? But like, I have to treat the cedar a bit more, or a bit of oak, you know? And then like, oh, what could I get these nice white pebbles with some bamboo on the side and pot plants? And it's going to be amazing.
Brilliant. I'm looking forward to the additions on Instagram, matey. Hey.
Instagram. I haven't posted on Instagram since the 10th of January as well. It's been amazing.
Right, nothing's really happening, is it?
Yeah, I've kind of taken a social media holiday since the beginning of January, so it's been great.
Yeah. Always a good thing to do. Before we wrap up, I have a series of questions which I ask people as I'm traveling on a day-to-day basis, and I'd love to, it's a big pile, but I'd love to just take a few and shoot them at you. Are you game?
Always.
What does adventure mean to you?
Well, I'm regurgitating something I've said since the beginning. For me, adventure is a way of thinking. So it's not about rowing oceans or climbing mountains. In its purest form, I think being adventurous is just a way of thinking. I think it's super important for us to think adventurously in everyday life, whatever the food you buy at the supermarket, where you choose to go on holiday, you know, X, Y, Z. I think adding a little bit of adventurous thought process into everyday stuff. I mean, you're the champion of that philosophy as well. You and Al, it's super important, you know.
What are you most proud of?
In my achievements, I would say swimming the length of Britain is the achievement I'll probably refer back to as the one that changed me it gave me the confidence to carry on. But actually, at the moment, I'm just proud that I've been able to, you know, kind of live this life that I thought was a dream, you know, and still be able to live a normal life with a family and a, you know, a son and a wife and a house, you know, a bungalow in North Wales. You know, I never dreamed I could have, I didn't dream the two would come together as well as they did. You know, I always thought there would be big sacrifices somewhere, whether it's the family sacrifice or the adventure sacrifice. But actually, at the moment, it's really merged beautifully, and I think I'm super proud to have made that sort of a reality, really.
What does living a good life mean to you, then?
Living a good life, spending time outside in natural lighting, eating healthy, and being fit. Those three things. If you can do those three things, you'll lead a good life. And then, of course, friends and family and social, your network of peers is also super important. But I think for the most part, if you're feeling a bit crap, go and spend more time outside, eat healthier and get fitter, and the other stuff will start lining up as well.
If you could change anything in your life, what would it be?
Ah, that's a good one. At the moment, nothing. For years, I would be like, I don't want to be ginger. But actually, at the moment, owning it. I'm owning the gingerness. Wiped out, don't worry. So, you know what, man? At the moment, I wouldn't change anything. Genuinely wouldn't. Like, I'm feeling pretty good about life at the moment.
What's your favorite place on this planet?
Whoa. So I know where it is. It's where my ashes are going to be buried. A place called Tumbu, T-H-U-M-B-U, which in Zulu means the small part of your intestines, because it's a river that looks like your intestines in South Africa. And there's this little camp on the side of the river that I used to go to with my dad and mum when I was a baby. And it's just magical. There's no electricity. There's no running water. If you want to shower, you sort of have to fill a bucket up. Put it on the fire, and then pull it up a tree with a rope and open a tap underneath, type thing. And yeah, I was just having these rustic memories of being on the edge of the Umfolozi River at Tumbu Camp with my dad with a gun, just in case the crocodiles came. That is my favorite place in the world, definitely.
What are you most afraid of right now?
I keep, who is it? Is it Chris Rock famously said, I always keep a travel bag packed at the front of my house for the day someone comes in and tells me, this is not yours, it's not real, you're going to have to leave. I'm afraid that, like, this life I live is going to end. Like, I love pushing myself physically. I love being a sports person. And of course it's going to end, you know, like, all sports, people who are in the world of sport will at some point need to consider their physical ability. I've still got some time. I'm only 39, so I've still got quite a few years ahead of me. But I'm just worried what I'll do when I can't do it anymore physically, you know. And I know I'll make a plan, but, like, I'm really enjoying being a sports person at the moment, and the idea of what's past it is kind of quite scary. So I tried to not think about it and just live in the moment and do everything I can to make the most of it now so that I have no regrets, you know.
If people have been listening to your stories over the last hour and they're thinking, man, you know, I've always had so many ideas, I just don't know how to get started, what would your advice be for them?
Make it public. Unless the idea is top secret, like my next idea, then don't make it public. No, what I mean is just tell people, you know, tell people about your idea. I think for the most part, the internet is super supportive of people. Genuinely, I do. I think it's a positive place. What I think, and I, of course, there's some terrible things that happen with bullying on social media, and that's horrible. But I also think sometimes we like to focus on the negative stuff that happens to us on social media because it's a better story. Now, of course, please, I'm not suggesting that bad things don't happen on social media, but you can also turn your phone off. Like, you know, and I find myself doing this, Dave, and I don't know, you probably don't do it, but I find I'll put a post out and there'll be 100 positive comments and there'll be one negative comment, but you know what? That's the comment I'll tell people about. I'll be like, oh, man, people, you know, I put something out there and I just got negativity about it. But like, no, I didn't really. I got one or two people saying I was an idiot or it wasn't possible. And I found myself choosing to tell that story because that's a kind of a captivating story, you know, and that's what people want to hear. And it's just, unfortunately, the world we live in, sensationalism, don't we, a little bit now. And, you know, I have in the past fallen foul of that. But I genuinely think, like, for the most part, I think people support your ideas nowadays. You know, I think they do. I think they do. And, you know, I think it's important to, and it's hard, it's important to ignore the people who say negative things. But because there's also so many positive people, you use that energy to move forward. So if anyone's got an idea to learn an instrument or, you know, do a hobby or whatever, then it's, you know, just put it out there and use the positivity of people around you.
Absolutely. Great answer. Okay, last question. Finish this sentence. The most important thing in life is?
My family. 100%. You know, if, and that's, you know, it's an obvious, boring one, and I know everyone will say it, but it is so true. It is so true. You know, everything else on the side at the moment is kind of fluffy. You know, the future of my son, you know, is super important, and my wife, and making sure they're happy and achieving their dreams and goals. And a lot of it depends on my dreams and goals. So it's not that I'm going to, you know, quitting adventure and not going away and staying at home would actually be a worse situation, because I want my son to be proud of me. You know, I want him to go, wow, Dad, no way, you cycled around the world once? Like, that's cool. I'm going to go and develop a new cure for cancer. If you can cycle around the world, I'm going to develop, you know, I can blim and go and achieve this thing that I want to achieve, you know. So there is a part of, you know, being away is tough, of course, but actually in the long term, it's more beneficial for my family than just being at home the whole time. And also because I'm at home every day, especially now, I think my wife's like, please, can you go away? Go and just do something, you know. Even last night, she was just like, I think you need to, she even said to me, she's like, Sean, I think you need to go and take your tent and go and sleep up a mountain tonight. I was like, but it's raining. So yeah, family's super important. Super important for me.
Brilliant. Sean, it's always great to catch up. Thanks so much for giving us an hour of your time. And yeah, look forward to coming and trying your outdoor shower sometime soon.
Ginger Olympics part 2. Come in the winter and we'll see who can stay in the outdoor shower the longest.
Game on.
If you're looking for inspiration for your next adventure, go no further than Sean's website, seanconway.com. Successes, dreams, hiccups and all. And he's also on Twitter, Conway_Sean, and Instagram at seanconwayadventure. Please subscribe so you don't miss any new episodes. And if you enjoy the podcast, I'd love it if you could leave a thoughtful review. Stay tuned for a feast of inspirational guests and tales that I very much hope will encourage you to begin your own new journey.